This podcast is brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those that love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew. It's the second in our series of Las Vegas lead up to CBC episodes. And for this one, I am in the north side of Las Vegas, sitting across from Dave Pasquale, head brewer, director of ops for Big Dogs Brewing, one of the winningest brewers, not only in Las Vegas, but maybe the entire state of Nevada. And I'm over your career, a lot of wins. Welcome to the podcast, Dave.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Big Dogs, over the last number of years, in 2022, won a bronze for Las Vegas Lager, GABF, gold for Naughty Dog in 2019, bronze for a Goza in 2019, gold for a Tripel in 2017, gold for Red Hydrant, English Style Brown in 2015. I mean, silver for it in 20. I mean, there's just all these medals. And then World Beer Cup, of course, 2023 bronze for another wood age, a wooden barrel aged strong ale. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of medals here, Dave.
Yeah, it's been fun, I won't lie.
Yeah. But what I also love about Big Dogs is that, you also play in classic styles as well as some more contemporary iterations and, kind of spanning those things and, making a winning tradition out of something like Red Hydrant English Style Brown Ale.
Yeah, I know. It's, the history of Big Dogs has been, we had a lot of award-winning brewers come before.
Sure.
So it just wanted to keep that going.
You had a reputation to live up to.
Yeah, had some boots to fill, I guess.
Sure. Well, you've done it. You've done it well. And of course, you have a winning tradition that came from the place you brewed. Before this, we'll talk about that when we get into that history. But we're going to dig in since, obviously, this is the lead up to Las Vegas CBC and World Beer Cup here in Las Vegas. So much pressure. But these episodes are to give those brewers listening out there something to get excited for and beers to check out while they're here in town. And that's why I'm here in advance talking to you and a couple others. We're going to dig into your approach to some of these classic as well as more progressive styles in a minute. But before we do that, at G&D Chillers, they always strive to build great chillers. Partner with them as you build great beer, but don't just take my word for it.
Hey, this is Josh Erickson of Jafuncta Brewing in Mandeville, Louisiana. The team at G&D were a critical part of our 10X expansion, always just a phone call or email away. And thanks to their superior equipment, technology, and documentation, commissioning our new chiller was smooth and straightforward. Now we can't wait until we need to upgrade our existing chiller.
That's right. Choose G&D chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring of your new G&D chiller. And ProBrew is changing the game at this year's CBC in Las Vegas. As part of ProMoc Craft Beer Solutions, they're presenting a holistic approach to craft brewing operations. Through their display of animations, holograms, and machinery, they'll be highlighting how they can advance every aspect of your production line. Visit go.probrew.com/CBC24 or contact them at contactus@probrew.com. to schedule one-on-one time with one of their subject matter experts at booth 1783 at this year's show, ProBrew, brew your beer. Also, are you struggling to source affordable citrus ingredients due to market fluctuations? Try Old Orchard's flavored craft juice concentrate blends, which mimic straight concentrates at a better price point and with a more reliable supply. Old Orchard's citrus-flavored blends include blood orange, grapefruit, lemonade, lime, and tangerine. To learn more and request your free samples, head on over to oldorchard.com/brewer. All right, Dave, we kick things off with a little bit of background. You've got a pretty good one here.
Yeah.
What got you into brewing?
What got me into brewing? Okay, so I did go to high school here. I went to UNLV as well. While I was at UNLV, getting my degree in biology and chemistry, I came across a brewer that taught a class. He taught an upper division course at the time of worldly beers, basically. So taking his class, any college kid, right, drinks beer in college. So it was an interest to me, and I needed it for credit anyways. So I was like, all right, let's go try it out. So take the class. It was my junior into senior year, and I end up getting the highest grade in there. I love beer that much, I guess, right? So we homebrewed in there.
You applied yourself.
Applied myself, okay. Yeah. So did that route, got the highest grade. The professor, like I said, was a local brewer in town. So he ran a brewery here, Barley's. His name is Michael Ferguson. But he got me in the brewing industry. He convinced me to take an internship, an unpaid internship, which, you know, I didn't realize what he was getting me into at that moment. But so I had to actually write.
College professors always taking advantage of free labor.
Free labor. And that's something I could use here. He got me in. So I started working under him, and I had to basically write the dean of the college, like, hey, I'm doing something that's related to science, you know, biology and chemistry, microbiology. So I wrote this like 2-page, basically an essay to him. Hey, this is why I should get credit for this. They allowed it, and I started working under him.
You got to pay the school for a credit.
Yes, exactly.
And then work for free. Yeah, because that's how that scam works.
Yeah, so I got in there, and at first I thought, oh, this is going to be cool. Easy job, you know, no problem. Thank goodness I was like fit. I was working out, but the amount of work that he put me up to, you know, it was interesting. I even wanted to continue to do this.
Sure.
So yeah, getting in the louder ton, cleaning it out, you know, he would say he gets in all the time, and you know, hopefully he's not listening to this, but you know, I was thinking like, there's no way a 6'4" man of your size could fit into these areas. So he had me do those type of work and cleanups and things like that. But that's basically how I got in the industry. So I learned a lot from that, but I also, you know, gained a respect, I guess, right, for what it is. And, you know, once I transitioned from, I guess, that internship, I graduated. I was supposed to go into the medical field. You know, I guess that's a typical thing for an Asian guy, right, to go in the medical field. So
you're not the first brewer over the last 6 weeks who, in fact, Kelly McKnight from New Belgium was going to pre-med, you know, at Harvard.
Oh, wow.
Left pre-med at Harvard to become a brewer.
And I think that's what it takes, right? You got to have like that certain mentality and intelligence maybe to even balance everything that we do. So
I'm going to work just as hard
and
make a tenth of the money.
I was just
going
to say a lot less. So an opportunity came at Chicago Brewing Company after I graduated. And I was like, you know what, let me just take a year off. Let me see where this goes. You know, it is very interesting. My mom was like, okay, you know, questioning it just a little bit. I took that year off, and now it's been almost 20 years, but that's how I got started. I took the job at Chicago Brewing Company, worked my way up as head brewer, and ran that spot for over 10 years before I came over to Big Dogs about 9 years ago.
I won a few medals over at Chicago Brewing in the process, and then came in here to Big Dogs, which also had a, you know, a strong history of crushing those medals and making great iterations of classic styles.
Yeah.
So, 9 years now at the helm of Big Dogs, what's that story been like? And what have you, you know, how where have things gone? How have things moved over that last 9 years of Big Dogs?
I think a lot has progressed. One reason why I came over here, and you know, I'm really appreciative, is that the family has been, you know, the owners. They're still the original owners.
Still the same family.
Still the same family. Yeah. But yeah, Kurt, he kind of runs it, the son of the original owner. But yeah,
because this Big Dogs started as Holy Cow Brewery, right?
Yeah,
back in the 90s.
On the strip.
And then,
the first brewery on the strip.
I remember going to Holy Cow way back in the day, probably 1995, maybe 1996.
Wow.
On the strip. I had just turned 21 in 1995 and was already drinking craft beer back there. And in fact, I should own up to this. Before we, you know, as we were emailing about this, I shared a photo with you. I've got a photo of me with a Jamaican ska singer, ska rock steady reggae singer, Laurel Aiken, where I'm wearing my Holy Cow t-shirt because I used to love that t-shirt. I wore it all the time.
I wish you still had it.
I know, but I have the picture of me and Laurel Aiken. Rest in peace, Laurel Aiken. as we were doing a cover shoot for my old ska magazine with Laurel at it's so fun to think back and, you know, look at that, because I remember it. I mean, that was a strange brewery. There was a lot of bright lights. Obviously gaming was a big part of it. It was unusual for a craft brewery at the time.
Yeah.
But fun, and obviously I was already in that seeking out craft.
Yeah, I wish I was old enough to be able to partake in it back then.
Now I'm dating myself, Dave. So anyway, you know, eventually moved out off of the strip, moved up here to the north yeah. side of town, yep. and was renamed Big Dogs mm-hmm. in honor of the original founder.
Yeah, Kurt's dad. Yeah, Kurt, Tom Wiesner. Okay. Yeah, he passed away of leukemia. And so when they moved the operations here mm-hmm. in the early 2000s, they decided to rename it in honor of his nickname, sure. which is the Big Dog.
Cool. So that's
the history of the name right there.
So, you know, you take the helm, you know, the brewing helm here, and obviously mm-hmm. there's high expectations for you because, mm-hmm. You know, you've made some really great beer at Chicago Brewing and, mm-hmm. and, you know, how did, but there's also expectations, you know, for the beers that, they're already known for,
yeah.
You know, what did you, you know, walking in here, how have you helped, you know, guide and shape the beer program over the last 9 years?
I think, what's great is that, and you know, everyone in the beer community here in Vegas are actually really good friends. So,
yeah.
The brewer previously here was a good friend of mine. So he kind of segued me into jumping into here, but, yeah, it's, you know, every brewery is different. I'm sure many people who've jumped from brewery to brewery will notice that. But what I imparted here, I just hope it was just my spin and just more of a mentality, of just making sure, you know, again, this is all, you know, just my personal take of how I view things. But, you know, having that science background kind of helps, you know, at least lay the foundation of what's important, you know, when it comes to brewing. So making sure things are just cleaned as possible, you know, as much as possible, to making sure all steps and processes are just followed through. So it was interesting because, remember, I came from a smaller brewery. I probably only had like one employee. So it was good to see growth in myself, but also just what I had to do here. So when we first started, or when I first started here at the brewery, it wasn't, production wise, wasn't as big as it's now. So we're a pub at heart, but we're also that pubduction, I guess, if you want to call it production.
Sure.
So seeing that growth, that's kind of what I've imparted or imprinted here at Big Dogs, was, you know, getting us to that next level.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why I think it's taking a little longer than other places, probably. The state of the economy sure, and how things are going now is probably slowing it down. But, you know, we just have a little bit more antiquated laws and things like that that kind of slow things down here. So, but no, yeah, as for what I think I've done here, I think I've just trying to build a culture with my teammates here, and, beer has always been the forefront. And, you know, when they brought me on here, Kurt Wiesner, you know, he basically just gave the keys and said, "Hey, you know, we trust you." I've known him before I even came here.
Sure.
And you know, I've hopefully built a great reputation with people in this town and the brewing industry. And, yeah, that's just kind of where we're going and heading at that. I'd like to give you a lot of answers on this, but we're still figuring it out. So, you know, we're at that cusp, I think, where, you know, we're making that jump, and the company's invested in certain things, our canning line expansions and things, but, you know, we're still working with the shoebox, and, you know, we're at max capacity of where I think we could be. We have a little bit of room for growth, but, you know, I'll let you know more as that happens in the near future, hopefully.
For sure. We can talk about what you're brewing on and how much you're brewing here in a minute. Before mm-hmm. we do that, Streamline Efficiency with Omega Yeast Diacetyl Knockout Series. The DKO series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diacetyl before it starts. The strains you know now better, available now for made-to-order pitchables at any volume. Contact Omega Yeast today at omegayeast.com. Also, ABS Commercial has been a full-service brewery outfitter for over 10 years. They're proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country, as well as equipment for distilling, cider making, wine making, and more. They know the ins and outs of the brewing and installation process and can design the perfect setup for you, whether you're just starting out or looking to expand. Contact them today at sales@abs-commercial.com to discuss your customized brewery needs. ABS Commercial, We are brewers. And if you're a brewer who's also interested in distilling, subscribe now to the Craft Spirits and Distilling Podcast, available on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Hosted by Sydney Jones, head distiller for Few Spirits in Chicago, and Molly Troop, master distiller for Freeland Spirits in Portland, Oregon. This podcast explores the technical and creative processes behind great spirits through conversations with some of the leading distillers working today. It's everything you love about the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast, but focused on distilling. Click on the link in the show notes and give it a listen. All right, Dave. So you've got a small brew house back there that was primarily designed to make beer for the pub here.
Yeah.
And now also is doing some, you know, production as well. How much beer do you produce every year? Tell me about the system.
Well, it's just a 15 barrel brew house. So we're kicking out beers. We have some 60 barrel tanks that we high gravity into. Our biggest selling beer.
High gravity is a theme down here.
Yeah.
last week, Matt was talking about Abel Baker was talking about high gravity brewing out of their 15 and pushing 23 barrels out of that. Yeah.
So the big plus about our system, which is shocking, it was a system from the late 90s. It's a JV Northwest system, but the mash tun was really oversized. So that worked out great for us because back then, you know, brewing, people weren't producing mashes, you know, of that volume and poundage. But yeah, just I only look at what I know experience-wise in my brewery.
Someone just wanted a thin mash bed for their lagers or something like that.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know, but it worked out great for us. You know, I get full yields even when we do barley wines, things like that. So last brewery I was at, you know, we couldn't do things like that. We can only fit, you know, 1,000 pounds in a 15-barrel mash. So, yeah, all interesting. Yeah.
So you're pushing how many barrels a year do you?
I think we're projected right now to do over 3,200, 3,300 right now. I know during COVID or right before COVID, we were skirting those numbers too. So, but yeah, we built back up on that. I'm sure everyone feels the same way. COVID kind of set things back, you know, not just in production, but you know, many other things, contract hops are one of them.
So what do you brew the most of?
Most of is our lager. Yeah. So we do our Las Vegas lager, the one that we took a medal, luckily enough, take a medal with at JBF in 22. But yeah, that's our biggest
American
production.
American light lager style?
Yeah, it's a contemporary American style lager.
Okay.
So, you know, it's just simple two row and, you know, we use a little bit of corn in there. And but yeah, how we approach that and what we do and what we're looking for profile wise, I think we hit it pretty good on the mark. And one beer you always hear from brewers or anyone else, it's always harder to hide, you know, the details, whether they're good or bad in a beer, you know. That beer was pretty fun just because in the namesake, you know, Las Vegas
lager. It's got a good brand.
Has a great name behind it. But yeah, that's our biggest production beer.
Yeah.
We do kick out a lot of that. It takes up all our 60 barrel tanks basically. I mean, rotate in and out of that every time.
That's a big volume beer to make out of a pretty small, tight brew house.
Yeah. And it's, rotating that, and it's a lager, so we still traditionally keep it as a lager. Mm-hmm. You know, 3-4 weeks is what we do with it. But yeah, it's not an ale. That's one thing, like, you know, you try to squeeze out as much as you can, but 2-week turnarounds would obviously be a lot better than a 4-week turnaround.
Yes, they would.
So yeah, that's just kind of where we're at. We're pushing the production
so
here.
So why two row, you know, versus, you know, kind of Pilsner malt and a light lager?
Well, you know, we've tried it too. I know cost is also one thing as well, but, profile wise, you know, it's very drinkable. It is your American lager with just a little more oomph to it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, we use a little touch more hops in it. We still do noble hops as well.
Hmm.
But yeah, simplicity was what we were looking for in this beer. And it's grown too, because I know we've added and done a little things to it, but I think as brewers, we're always trying to perfect or be better. You know, you can never be complacent, right? So that's kind of how I approach everything.
For example, what are some of the kind of process or, you know, ingredient tweaks that you've made, you know, to that lager that you found have made, you know, an impact?
Well, yeast strains, switched different yeast strains through the years too, as well. You know, you can use a traditional American style. I know, you know, we were getting a little bit more of that green apple, which is typical for that style. You know, I personally like it a little bit more subdued, but, you know, switching even to like a German style strain, you know, a little cleaner as well. But hops were one thing that we had to really like dial in. Mm. You know, we were using American varieties at one point and wanted to keep it. Hey, let's, you know, let's go something a little cleaner, floral, and you know, touch grassy. So we went back to noble hops using into that. So again, we do use a little bit more hops.
What noble hops do you favor on that? Because I mean, right now we're in a weird time for noble hops.
It is. With, I mean, you can't even get
some of the climate change stuff.
Yeah, like middle fru.
Right.
Yeah. So that's something that we tend to use actually a decent amount of is that. So
yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of what, you know, profile wise. Like I said, we're always trying, and like you said, like depending on what's available to us. So for a while, we couldn't even get it. You know, and we're lucky enough to actually get a contract. You know, it's little worrisome when your biggest production beer and you're struggling to find contracts for those ingredients. But I think we got lucked out here. In the next couple of years, we should be okay now.
Okay.
But yeah, that's just something, you know, simplicity, but balance. And for me, when I'm approaching a beer, you know, you got to try other people's beers. I mean, that's just what it is. You know, you got to emulate what you think out there is what profile wise everyone's trying to achieve. Yeah, for me, I'm trying beer all the time. I know it's to the point where, yes, I have to eat lunch or eat something just to make sure that I'm not getting too buzzed in the morning. That's just part of it. But yeah, anytime we're doing something, whether it's a different change or just constantly, just always trying the beer. So I'm probably the worst person because I'm so critical of myself, and not just in beer, by the way, but many things. And I think it carries over into what I do. But yeah, I'm either hyper focusing on one thing or I maybe just, I don't think I am, but you know, and that's why I balance it out with my other brewers, just kind of thinking like, hey, am I actually getting this profile or is it because I'm hyper focusing on these issues? So, but no, yeah, that's just kind of how I approach things all the time. So
sure. On something like a light lager, I imagine the IBU goal is going to be, you know, pretty small.
Yeah.
You know, what, 12 IBUs, 15 max.
Yeah, right around there.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and so that's a pretty light hop expression.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting to, you know, for you to tell me that the hops, you know, were something, you know, that you particularly worked on, given that it's such a minimal expression there.
Yeah.
You know, how do you think about that kind of flavor contribution in such a light beer where, I mean, they're making incredibly small moves at that kind of point.
Yeah.
These are going to be all hot side, you know, and there's no real aromatic.
Yeah. There's no dry hop, nothing like that.
No whirlpool on this one.
Yeah. No, actually we do a little. Yeah, we do a little, you know, we try to get as much out of it, you know, so we are hopping on the front end in the middle. We're also adding some on the back end too as well. I mean, no dry hop in this, but, but yeah, no, we're just looking for
whirlpooling though.
Yeah. Yeah. Just water. A little bit. Yeah, I know. Maybe I'm telling too much now, but
this is what we do on the podcast.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's we're looking for a well-rounded profile.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we've, like I said, through the years, we've tried things, done things. And even the old brewer, Dave Otto, before me, he even brought up one time coming here, he was like, oh, I noticed you have a little bit more hop character in here. And it's like, well, yeah, you picked it up. I mean, if you try it, you know it. So, yeah.
Well, maybe that's the little difference maker.
Yeah. You know what? Funny enough, I've talked to other brewers that have won medals and stuff, and they always say like, oh, it's just probably just because it's just a little bit more of this ingredient that stands out. I mean, I don't know how the judges judge, but something has to differentiate you from the others, right? So
you're playing, it's a game of inches there, yes, at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish I knew. I mean, I get that question like, oh, how did you win in this category? I don't know. You know, it's like I try to produce a beer that I think is stylistically to what, you know, the judges are looking for, or just even to the guidelines. That's just it, you know. And I think most of the time though, you know, most of us don't brew to a style. You know, we tend to brew a beer and then figure out, oh, it does fit this a little well, you know, it might do well in here. And you know, I've had my fair share of stories on, you know, beers that have won medals, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I want a medal for that. But
you
want
to brew for your audience first.
Yes,
you know, for the
exactly.
people that are going to buy your beer, and you want to make the beer for them, and then you find the category that it fits into.
Yeah, that's what it is. Every year we're looking like, okay, I think this fits better in here. Yeah. A cream ale versus a blonde ale. You know, I think this one's better.
Oh man, I love that cream ale versus Mexican lager category. Like you see these beers, like, oh, all right. What you sell the beer that's your customer, at versus what category you enter it into in a competition. It's always interesting to see.
Yeah.
Anything else interesting about light lager?
No. I mean, outside of being a fantastic beer.
What else do you brew a lot of?
A lot of here. We do our IPAs, we do a pale ale. That's one of our bigger sales, but that Red Hydrant you brought up too, English brown ale, that's one of our core beers that we do.
Core English brown ale.
I know.
Well, let's talk about that, because that's not a beer that any other brewers out there listening to this are going to be rushing to rip off from you. So you can share some of your techniques in brewing that with us, knowing that, but this beer existed when you came into...
Before.
So this was a legacy beer that you inherited and that you had to, also continue its legacy. Yeah. Talk to me about what it was, and then how that has massaged over time.
So, one of the first brewers was Dan Rogers, and he brewed this beer originally before. So this is your time on the
Several
early 90s.
Brewers ago, yeah.
And then he was here for a good amount of time, and then Dave Otto came on after him. And so that was one thing. When he came on board, or when I came on board, he just took a medal for it, took a gold medal for it, and it was pretty awesome. And then I took over, and then one thing he was telling me is like, Pasquale, that beer has not changed since I've been brewing it. And it's been similar recipe-wise since Dan Rogers was here. So that was like, if it ain't broke, why change it? Almost kind of a mentality on that. But through the years, everything changes, right? Like ingredients, agriculture, so many things affect profiles and how things taste. And but on the most part, that's basically a very similar recipe from when it was originally brewed. So that's kind of cool to have that and to see through the years how it's progressively continued to do really well at competitions, but also more importantly, how well it does across our pub here or even out in market. Mm-hmm. It's a classic style beer. Not many people seem to gravitate toward it, but it's held its own in the past few years. So, it's just a fantastic style of beer if you're looking for something like that.
You can do well with it because other people aren't, it fits that one thing that...
A little niche almost.
And there are folks that love brown ales and,
That's what got me in the brewing industry.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I mean, it was like Hefs and brown ales, That was me drinking in the late 90s and the early 2000s. So.
Yeah. Well, how do you approach brown ale? How do you build this recipe?
Okay.
For brown ale.
Well, darker beers for me, even this rolls over into even when you brew like Belgian beers or, like a Belgian Double or, a dark strong or whatnot. Characteristically, it's just finding a multitude of ingredients that can impart characters that you're looking for. I know that sounds very simple, but a lot of it's based on me just trying and tasting. And that's why I said, I'm always trying and tasting a beer. Profile wise, at least when it comes to like building a malt profile, we're looking at different varieties of caramels. We're looking at also, what's going to give us a little bit more like toast or biscuit. Obviously biscuit malt will do that, a touch of chocolate, touch of roast, just finding the right amounts of those. And when I came here, we were using, all the ingredients are basically the same in the Red Hydrant that we produce, but amounts have maybe changed just subtly, whether, our supplier no longer carries this, product anymore.
Sure.
Oh, we have to order from this person, but now we have to order pallets from them. But on the most part, like when you look at like ingredients and how everything is like come together, it's basically been the same. So, but brown ales, finish a touch sweet, I think helps this too as well. Using some of those darker roast malts as well, like helps build up some characteristics in there. Like a variance in like caramels also. So it's not just one caramel we're using several different ones that are helping to build that rounded profile. that you look in that malt profile that we're looking for.
Yeah. Are there some that you really enjoy in there?
Ingredient wise, just trying
and
to
these think. Are probably a couple of percentage of each of these within a kind of a broader
I mean malt wise I'm trying to think we do percentages of like said dark malts, like whether it's roast or touch chocolate in there, just to give it a little bit more oomph to it, but mostly just a variance of caramel malts, like ranging from 30 up to 70 or 80, we're using different amounts of those to kind of impart those characters.
But, and then just a standard 2-row base for this. I imagine
2-row. Yeah,
I imagine if you're using 2-row in your light lager, that it's probably your base across.
Yeah,
we
save the good stuff for other beers too as well. So,
is there a 2-row that you really love?
2-row.
Is there a base malt that you?
Yeah, base malt. Like, I mean, I love Pilsner. I love using that in beers, but we use that in certain beers, but no 2-row, we've used Rar, we've used country malts also as well. It's been, again, traversing the market now and like contracting your 2-row, that's always been interesting too. Just trying to figure out what's going to work best for us cost wise too. So, but right now we're currently with country malt. So, we're using 2-row through them and it's been fantastic. I have no qualms about it and making some great beers with it. So
nice. Well, let's pivot and talk about some of the Belgian style beers that you really love brewing, because maybe even Goza, because you've won a medal for that one too recently. And these feel like some of your brewing projects that we might be able to, that maybe I can squeeze and get more details
more
out
specific
of in some way or another, maybe somehow. I'm gonna keep trying before we do that. This episode is sponsored by Yakima Chief Hops as a global preferred supplier of NZ hops. Yakima Chief is the source for the pronounced, bright, and tropical aromas New Zealand hops are known for, adding a rush of exotic fruits and zesty citrus to your recipes. Used on their own or in conjunction with your favorite American varieties, NZ Hops brands are an excellent tool for exceptional brews. NZ Cryo is now available through Yakima Chief Hops. Learn more at yakimachief.com. Also, if you're opening or expanding a brewery, getting your building right is one of the most important things you'll ever do. The architects at OPA Design Studio are your partners in developing the unique design you need. With over a decade of experience designing breweries, the folks at OPA are here to serve as your trusted experts from start to finish with their full range of architectural services. Visit designopa.com to set up your no obligation introductory consultation today. All right, we're going to get into this, Dave. I'm going to find some way, somehow.
It's my sweat.
But maybe let's talk about, Triple Dog Dare. That's a beer. Is that one of yours? Is that one that predated you?
Well, I was also brewing a similar beer at Chicago Brewing Company.
Oh, so that's one you brought with you.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So not name. I mean, it's totally different name, but yeah, I brought some of the experiences that I had.
Of course. Your philosophy towards brewing Belgian style beers. So talk to me about designing that beer. Where was your inspiration? It was interesting. When you head to Belgium, like Triple is everywhere. It's that standard beer, I did not, it's pretty amazing just how, that's the beer that everybody drinks.
And
there are lots of different approaches and iterations to it.
Yes.
It's a much more diverse style, as a whole than we might think of it here.
Yeah. So again, this is just my personal take, everything,
that's all any of these ever
opinions, how I approach it. But beer wise, you want to use traditional ingredients as much as you can. Use a lot of Pilsner malt in them. I think, again,
you start writing
the
recipe. Where do you start writing the recipe?
When do I start writing?
Where do you start when you're writing the recipe for this?
I kind of keep, I found a sweet spot and I kind of kept with it, but, just making sure that you're using Pilsner malt is a good base.
Sure.
Pilsner is a good base. So we used some wheat malt in there too, as well.
What does the wheat impart?
Well, it helps with some of the body too, like sure. some of the head retention.
It's true. You got to have good foam on a, yeah. a Tripel.
So using that as a good base, simplicity always takes you so much further. You know, the yeast does a lot of the work for mm-hmm. you. And, you know, I've used yeast from whether it's White Labs, Y Yeast, you know, even Lallemand's Abbey Ale, you know, that's those are solid yeasts that you could use. But profile wise, I'm always trying to just... Again, my personal take is that I like the fruit notes. You know, I like the banana notes that are in there. Like the spicy clove, I do like that. I like it personally a little bit more subdued. So we're trying to make sure that we're getting like those nice banana. You know, you get even sometimes like that pear kind of character that you can get in there. But that's what I want to showcase more of. And again, all traditional ingredients, we try to use as much Pilsner malt. We use,
right. Obviously fermentation is going to feed into some of that expression, but also, yeah. mm-hmm. you know, but malt and hops that, you know, creating some of these other, you know, mm-hmm. kind of precursors for that fermentation to also mm-hmm. work on, you know, as a piece of that too. How do you balance those things? Are there any ingredient considerations that you make, you know, knowing that it's going to express differently, you know, through the fermentation process?
Yeah. I mean, some of the biggest ones are like the temperature control, you know, mm-hmm. at least for us when we're using it in the fermenter and setting our temp there. So, you know, I know some people free rise, you know, they let it, when they knock out whatever their temp is, they kind of let it go up.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't like happening is, and it's kind of burned me a couple times, is that I wouldn't say I start off high as possible, but I'll leave it at a certain temp, you know, like say 78, and then eventually control it and then let it free rise. So again, that's just what I do, and it's worked in the past. I've had issues where, you know, the glycol basically turned on too soon or something, and it stopped the fermentation, you know, so it stalled it out. But no, yeah, it's just not making sure the temps aren't going too high are very important for me. Cause I've been to Belgium. I've tried triples over there and, you know, all kinds of beers, and it was really fun. You know, it was my last hurrah before my wife said, "We're having a kid, you know, you got one last chance to do something." So I did it, and I decided to go to Belgium. So,
good choice.
Yeah. Beer wise, you know, some of the best beers, you know, produced there are just very drinkable. So that's what I tried to emulate. So when I first started brewing Belgian beers was at Chicago Brewing Company. And the old brewer there, for instance, and, you know, to save costs, would just not use traditional inverted sugar or, you know, Belgian candy sugar.
Right.
And I've always noticed it was just slightly different. I know that stresses out the yeast a little bit and maybe not in good ways, but I decided just like, you know, there was other things he did and I'm not going to, you know, go into it, but I was more interested in making it a classic style because I've tried other ones. I've tried bottles, you know, from Belgium, and it just characteristically, it wasn't there for me. So I just trying to hone that in, you know, from my personal take. And that's, it's so interesting to me how profiles and, you know, subtleties and how the brain processes it. It's so different across different people. But for me and what I looked for, it's just easy drinking, not high alcohol notes, you know, and you keep those hidden.
Sure.
I mean, our triple here, you know, even the one that won the medal was hovering around 10%, but it drank like a 6% beer. But yeah, that those little tricks or things that you could do to minimize some of those characteristics that I think that type of expression, I think, was definitely something you want to avoid, especially the alcohol. But that was something I was working really hard to do. And I think, like I said, we haven't really changed it much in the past few years, you know, making sure that.
Yeah. So what is that key to, you know, controlling? Obviously, temperature, as you mentioned, is mm-hmm. a piece of this. You know, is there, you know, a pitch rate question on that, you know, because the stress obviously with these yeasts will, you know, create characters in different kinds of ways.
Yeah.
You know, is there something to the, you know, fermenter geometry and the, you know, because obviously with these yeasts that can also impact things. Head pressure can impact things. What are some, you know, are there some of these other things that you'd use to control that kind of, you know, higher alcohol expression?
Yeah, no, most of it has honestly been temperature control.
No.
I think that's a big part of it. As for pitch rates, we pitch exactly what it is. I've been burned before again on, hey, let's see if we can get more esters out of this, you know, even on a hef, surprisingly. But no, we make sure that we're pitching proper amounts in each one of our batches here. You know, the biggest thing is also trying to find out, hey, what kind of variables can we control, right? Minimize your variables. So knowing that we put the proper pitch rate in there is one less thing that we have to consider when we're trying to figure out, hey, what went wrong in this batch, you know? And mind you, when I say things go wrong, it's not, oh, it's undrinkable. No, it's just like subtleties that I personally think shouldn't be there. Or
this one is good, but might not be our competition batch.
Yeah. I admit that. Funny story. We had a conversation once, and maybe this is the platform to like at least like, you know, put your feather in your cap kind of thing, but no way am I bragging. But we, one year we took a bronze at GABF, and I was talking to one of my brewers, Amanda. She now runs another brewery in town. But I was like, hey, this beer is, you know, the following year after we won the medal, it's like, this beer is really good. I'm telling you, it's hitting the marks. It's even better than the year previous. And then sure enough, GABF, we were honored with receiving a gold that year for that. So, yeah, those little subtle changes, like I think, you know, as brewers, we have to be honest with ourselves, right? Like that's why you try beers. Yeah. Not, you know, you're comparing yourself. That's just what it is. Comparing where that beer is, your beer, other people's beers. You got to do that at some point because, you know, no one's going to tell you, at least some people won't tell you to your face if you're doing something wrong. So, you know, you got to get yourself out there and drink more beer. And that's something I admit I need to do more of, is try more people's beers, you know, and that's, you know, having a kid and that doesn't help, you know.
Sure. That's one of the nice things about my job. I get to go meet up with people, drink their beers, and try a lot of these beers. But no, I know what you're saying there. And I think there is, like, you know, you can decry, you know, the competition, but there's something to the friendly competition, you know, and also understanding, like, because, you know, beer doesn't exist in a vacuum. Like, it's everyone drinking beer has context, you know, and the context can change. Obviously, the context of drinking, you know, triple in Belgium is a little different than the context of drinking triple here in the United States. But, you know, having said that, anyone who's ordering that has, they have, you know, these past experiences that come in a way in that. And it's good to think about what those are. While at the same time, as you mentioned, like, ingredients keep changing year after year, you know, your beers, if you want them to, you know, hit the same way, also people's palates change year after year. Like, you know, you think about, like, our palates are all influenced by the food and drink that we consume. And that's going to be different depending on where you are in the country or, you know, around the world. And, you know, but then all of a sudden, you know, we start drinking, you know, roastier and roastier coffee, and it changes our threshold for, you know, for what roasty really is. And, and those things do change. Our palates change just like the ingredients change. And so for beers to hit the same way, some of those have to, you know, kind of grow and evolve too.
Yes. And that's the challenge, right? When it comes to brewing, it's never be complacent and just keep pushing forward and trying to make anything better. You know, and I've, you know, beers that we, again, taken medals with, I changed them. You know, it's like, does it mean this year it's going to be any different? And, you know, I've looked at even barley wines that, you know, we took medal in 19 for that. It's changed as well. You know, we, like you said, we weren't hitting certain profiles that we were getting previously. So we try to figure out, okay, what did we do? Let's, you know, we do some extensive notes, but, you know, looking back on certain things, like how we are able to get those characters, or at least squeeze more out of it to get those characters that we know were very, you know, poignant or just what we feel put us over the edge. Because, you know, at JBF, the good thing about it is that you can try other people's beers, right? Because you're on the fest floor, you can say, like, I'm the guy that, hey, I see a guy want a medal or a brewery want a medal, like, or whoever won the medal, and go right in that line. I don't care. I got to get better at it, though, because I'm not as good as, you know, Matt Marino did it at Able, but he's so, can easily just walk behind and skip the line kind of thing. And it's like, oh man, I guess if I had a medal, that would make it look much easier to do.
You gotta put that around your neck before.
Here's my credentials right here. Can I try one of your beers, please?
Well, you know, tell me about that with Naughty Dog. You know, the barley wine that you're talking about. I've had a similar conversation a year or two ago with, Hutch and Jonathan from Cannonball Creek, you know, talking about pale ale.
Those guys kill it all the time.
Pale ale and IPA. Exactly. They kill it. They, you know, they win a lot of medals. But they also were like, you know, we won a medal and then we went back and changed the recipe to make it more like what we want to. And that's a bold thing to go do.
It is.
Now that you've already like set a standard for this, you know? So with something like barley wine, you know, what was your process then of tasting and thinking, I think the next iteration of this should highlight, you know, this a little bit more, and this is how we want to shift that.
Yeah.
How do you go about deciding what to change and how to change it?
Well, the only way you can do it is if you have data, right? So our data was just, hey, let's brew this beer again and see, you know, try to mimic as much as we can. Well, as we realized, like, certain things were obviously different. And it's like, again, profile-wise was hitting, but it wasn't hitting as much as we'd like in certain areas. So we went back to the drawing board and just looked at ingredients, looked at, you know, barrels that we were using. You know, we're a smaller brewery, you know, for Vegas, we're one of the bigger ones, but you know, overall, and space wise is always something we have to figure out. So storing barrels was a whole nother thing. So we even considered where we position it to, you know, how long is it sitting in this area here? How high is it? You know, how much moisture is in our room? So, we try thinking and controlling as much of the variables again, is what we can, you know, what we can do. But yeah, no, it was ingredients. I think some of the ingredients that we used, we substituted. We didn't have them available to us at the time. So when we did the brew set, that was a big change, I think, from us from 1 year to the next.
I guess, yeah, 2019 into 2020 would have absolutely, that would have been a time where... there were some certain ingredient constraints in 2020.
Like, okay, we can't get that right now. But... you know, even in your mistakes, you learn so much, right? Or I wouldn't even consider it a mistake. It was just trying something different, right? And seeing what it is and just knowing in your mind how you categorize that. So we tried different yeast strains. We got back and, you know, what we produce now is, I think, on par with what we did in 19. And we did it too, not too long ago. What was it, 21? That was also the same. But yeah, it's just... you know, taking good notes and looking at what you're doing and trying it. That's the only thing I could say is like trying as that progresses. And we realized too, like just for a little trick, and I don't know if other people do it, but we have better results if we barrel age through the winter, you know, versus summer. And, you know, it would make sense here with the heat and how arid it is here. But that works out better for us too as well. And then finding that sweet spot, certain beers, you know, we do 3 months, certain beers we do a little bit more. I mean, beers, wine barrels, you name it, like so many different, you know, variables, but it's all about us just remembering, note-taking, profiling it like, hey, this is what we like. And, with me, I'm very, you know, I talk with my crew. It's not, everything's not internal, at least when it comes to like, you know, ideology or at least how we want to approach something, you know, it's more like, hey, this is what we're doing. What do you guys think? And then they throw their 2 cents in as well. So, you know, I'm not the only one here and these guys are fantastic and, you know, they help me out with a lot of things as well. So yeah, it's a team effort for sure.
That sounds to me like a kind of a shorter barrel residence time for a barrel aged barley wine.
Yeah.
Which brings its own design constraints, obviously. Like, you know, I've talked in the past to, you know, Marty and Jim at Revolution and they, you know, have some very high gravity, you know, into barrel, you know, 20 Play-Doh, kind of very sweet stock that's built to last, you know, for a couple of years of barrel aging. And, you know, obviously if your goal is barrel aging for 3 to 6 months, you know, now you probably need a leaner beer and it's not simply, you know, you're not just simply, you know, brewing, blending stock out of that, but talk to me about how you approach that. Is that you make a single stream beer then that goes, you know, into barrels.
Yeah.
And then how do you think about, you know, the way that gravity, time, and the barrel interact with each other?
Yeah. When we brew beers here, it's normally just a single batch when it comes to barrel aging, unless we're doing a big program.
Barrel aged barley wine is not a big thing for anyone.
No.
Especially not, you know, for big dogs.
Even doing a 15 barrel of that. Yeah, that's a decent amount.
Sure. Revolution, they put it in cans. They, you know, like they do, they have a pretty good market now for these barrel aged beers and they have some flexibility in how they do things comparatively.
I think there's definitely a market for it. But no, the way we look at it and how we approach it, I'm trying to think here. Because we've had barrel aged some of those beers. So that funny one, the one that won the medal at World Beer Cup last year, that was technically a barley wine.
Yeah.
But it was a 9 year old barley wine.
9 years old.
So, it's just.
You entered a 9 year old barley wine?
Yeah.
And won a bronze medal.
Won a bronze medal in the
World Beer Cup. Yeah. 20. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know.
How do you even have, it was that 9 years, packaged and sat in a bottle for that long?
No, it was in a can. It was in a keg can.
Okay.
Yeah, we had it sitting in a keg and sometimes we pull beers. That's just how it is. You know, we have beers and we're deciding what to do with it and it just kind of got lost in the shuffle. So,
So you just find this magical keg that's been sitting cold?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's so funny. There's a story. Okay. One of my guys, Marshall, we were clearing out stock. So we just built out a cooler, which should be three times bigger, but, we're running tight on space. So he was clearing out some old stock of beer that we were like, oh, we'll blend it. We'll do this. You know, like we had old barrel aged beers and we're like, okay, let's just start clearing out. There's just no way we can store these, you know, extra kegs of beer. So unfortunately he started getting rid of them. I walked by him when he was happening to be like dumping it on the ground. Basically, I'm like, hold on, what is that? And I look at it, the tag is worn off, and I was like, that smells fantastic. So I grab a cup, start drinking it, and I'm like, oh my goodness, this is really good. We should hold on to this just a little bit longer. So we were going to release it for opening up our new bar in our barn area or something like that. And then we were just like trying it. I'm like, oh my God, this beer is really good. It'd be really interesting if we turn this into competition and see how well it does. And I was so shocked that this beer did anything, but hey, you never know, right? If you never turn something in. But profile-wise, again, it was very consistent.
Extended lagering in a cold conditioning for 9 years in a keg.
And that one, I'm pretty sure.
It had been barrel-aged.
Yeah, we barrel-aged that for, that one was like right around 6 months because it was right when I came on Big Dogs around then. But that beer was fantastic. And it was very similar to the 19 beer that we happened to win a medal with too as well. So characteristically, it worked out and, you know. It was fun to see that one actually win. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into that. You know, how does a beer that old, you know, sitting just in a cooler maturate? And it seemed to have maturated really well. I mean, took a medal with it. So
That's crazy. Of course, now you can't repeat that.
No,
there's no brewery that's gonna be like, we're going to just age these kegs for 9 years.
Oh, man.
Your CFO.
Hopefully,
like,
we're still alive.
What are you doing
around
with a cooperage for 9 years? You know how much that costs? It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So it was fun. That one also, again, like I said, was very similar to the barley wine that we produce now. So, and how we approach that. So, different barrels in part. You know, certain characteristics. So we have a local distillery it's a distillery in town, but they supply some of our barrels too as well. But, just having good relationships with our barrel brokers, I'm always pushing her when I do reach out and like, how fresh are they? When were they emptied? Where are they coming from? A lot of things play into it's so weird to narrate this and like talk about it. You know, these are things that just go on in my mind and like, whether or not, like I said, there's proof behind it or the data, or is this all just, just in my mind? But that's things like this, it tends to work out. So, yeah.
I mean, that's all any of this is different people's approaches and, things they've learned. I mean, that's the interesting thing about brewing too, right? We could talk about process, ingredients and everything else, but like if they're not brewing on your system and your brew house, like the different, results may vary.
Yeah. And, everyone has access to the same ingredients. You know, it's just how you manipulate it. Right. I don't know. Like it's tough.
Let me talk about
building.
Like, I am still interested in like designing barley wine for, a shorter aging period again, because, a lot of the, typical mainstream in that kind of barrel aging would be now the trend is longer. Aging.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And even a year would be, pretty minimal for some people. So 3 to 6 months It's a pretty rapid time, which means you're designing beer to, again, to pick that up fast.
We try. I mean, we're trying the barrels as they maturate. So that's one thing. You know, you're investing so much product into
something.
How often
do you sample those? Because, right, the difference between 3 and 6 months can be, and if that's your time frame.
Yeah, and barrels.
If your goal is 2 years, and it's like you're not going to taste them until you're at least a year, right?
Yeah, and some of the barrels, I mean, they're so different from each other. Mm-hmm. You know, you get characteristics. You're like, oh, wow, this one still tastes like the wort, you know, or the base beer, you know. And then you have others that are like, wow, you know, the whiskey's really coming through. And then, you know, we've had beers that we've aged and they've actually cleaned up a little bit, you know? So, for instance, you know, you get some of the acetone like notes that you can get in some barrels.
Sure.
We've had some of that kind of clean up. And then when you barrel blend them, you tend to not notice it. So it's just enough threshold to give it that, you know, that roundness, I guess we're looking for, when we're putting beers together and at least where they want to finish at. We do go in a little bit sweeter. That tends to help out, you know, you know, the simple explanation for that is that, you know, we're trying not to, you know, the tannins in the woods, you know, provide like that sucking on a popsicle. And it's like that little bit of drying action. So you need some of that sweetness to kind of counteract that. But yeah, outside of that, it's just a traditional barley wine that we try to keep as traditional as possible. So ingredient wise, we're not doing anything weird. You know, it's like we're still hitting the colors. We're, you know, the threshold of the color we're looking for. And 1 year, again, it was during COVID, but that was what I was telling you about. It's like we had substitute ingredients that we weren't able to get before. And we were overshot on some of our color a little bit just because we've never used some of that ingredient. Even though our calculations said it was going to be fine, it was slightly darker. Caramel is a big part of the barley wine that we look for. It's like a rich caramel character. And, you know, everyone wants that in a barley wine. But that was one big thing that we try to really push when it comes to the finished product.
And so just like your brown ale, it's going to use a range of caramel malts.
Yeah. So darker, richer malts, you know, you want to utilize. And you know, a lot of what I'm comparing, like the, you know, you try other people's beers, but you don't know the recipe, right? But again, that's like kind of the basis of what I look at. It's like, wow, I really like what this brewery does. I really like what they do here. I like the profiles here. How can I emulate that? But yeah, there's, you know, for us, it's just what we try from year to year and like where we see how things progress and like what we liked of a certain characteristics if we had to substitute certain barrels. So that's another thing too, is that we keep a stock of barrels and then we try to do another, whether it's bourbon or whiskey, whatever we're doing, and trying it in that as well. And then we can actually compare and see like, hey, you know, profile wise, what are we picking up here? We get more lactones out of this. Oh, we get more vanilla, you know, out of this one. So we've done that too, as well as just like kind of using different bourbon barrels and whiskey barrels to kind of see where it progresses too. So, but yeah, that's all we have is comparative data is what we generate here and single batches. So
sure.
It's a little stressful when you're, you know, producing only like six, you know, barrels of, to age, and then that's all you have, and putting all your eggs in those baskets in hopes that, you know, something comes out great out of it. So
for sure. Well, looking at it from a big picture perspective, you hinted at it at the start, but I want to kind of come back around to it in terms of, you know, creating a culture of excellence and building a team, you know, that is all pushing towards that. What do you think are some of those kinds of key factors that continue, you know, to make you all successful? You know, not because it's, again, you're right, it's not just you, it's the entire team all pulling in the right direction. And, you know, what are some of those things, you know, that you know, you all focus on that, you know, push towards that idea of broader brewing excellence?
Well, you know, you have to have the team feel like a team. And I think that's a big push for me, is just making sure that everyone that's part of having their hand in it is, they also see the end result of it. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, like you cleaning kegs, that's a very important part, you know, but communication is also another thing too. It's like, you know, just talking with the team. Like you said, I touched base with it earlier. It's like, it's not just my way or the highway kind of thing. I know that was a mentality with some of the brewers I've worked with in the past. And, but no, it's just being open. You know, I admit I don't know everything, you know, and I might forget something, you know, that all happens. But, you know, that communication with the team, just making sure like, hey, you guys are involved as much as I am, you know, just because I'm technically your boss doesn't mean I have to be your boss, you know, like in those aspects. But yeah, it's just making sure that they're included on decisions as well. You know, some things, yes, I have to make the decision on ultimately, but I still refer to them because I trust them,
yeah.
You know, and I think that's a big part is like trusting your team. And yeah, I think it's worked out pretty good. You know, hoping everyone here is happy. I'm happy still. So
sure.
It's a big plus.
Well, since we've got a lot of brewers coming in town for CBC in a few weeks, I'm trying to close this special mini series of Las Vegas episodes with your personal recommendations. What are some of your favorite beer things and favorite non-beer things to do in Las Vegas?
Oh man. Well, there's more of the Vegas than the strip, you know,
for
hiking.
Sure,
I was telling you, but off the air is like, you know, going hiking. So we're probably going to do a hike this weekend. But yeah, it's like we're going to do the Springs hike. Hot Springs hike here.
Ooh,
but
nice.
Yeah, the Red Rock Canyon's really beautiful too as well. A lot of mountain biking things mm-hmm. that you could do. But in town, yeah, I'll be honest, I'm a little boring. I like to do outdoor stuff. You know, I do trips with the wife and kids, but I do need to get out more. That's
you've got to have some beer racks within Las Vegas.
Yeah. Well, okay. Places to eat. Like there's a lot of solid places to eat. Our friends at Latai, that's a solid spot down downtown. Trying to think. Thai food is, you know, you got to eat Lotus of Siam. Like if you guys ever make it down, like there's several locations that they have, but that is like that Thai food was voted the best Northern Thai food outside of Thailand. So
nice.
Yeah, it's a very, very good restaurant. Highly recommend that. But no, as for, you know, around town, like what you want to know, watering holes I go to?
Sure.
All right. Yeah. Silver Stamp, our friend at Silver Stamp.
Of course.
You know that. So,
yeah.
But they're awesome. We have friends at Cerveza, but, you know, any one of the Beer Centric 595, like those guys are all, you know, top notch and, you know, good friends of ours too. So it's funny. Like, I can't get out of the beer industry. Even when I'm at home, I'm just constantly going places that, you know, revolve around what we do as work. So it is definitely a lifestyle that you choose to get into when you become a brewer. But yeah,
it definitely is. And, you know, folks coming in are going to get to experience a little bit of your Las Vegas lifestyle in the same kind of way. But Dave, I think that's a good place to bring this to a close. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring. Schedule a time now to meet with Pro Brew at CBC booth 1783. Old Orchard is the go-to source for fruit forward ingredients for some of the biggest names in the craft brewing landscape. Omega Yeast's Diacetyl Knockout series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diacetyl before it starts. ABS Commercial are proud to offer brewhouses tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country. If you're a distiller or curious about it, check out the Craft Spirits and Distilling Podcast. As the global preferred supplier of NZ hops, Yakima Chief is your source for great New Zealand hops, now available in cryo. And the architects at OPA Design Studio are your partners in developing the unique design you need. If you've enjoyed this podcast or any others, go to beerbrewing.com, click on that subscribe button, become a subscriber, and help us bring great stories to you, great podcast episodes week after week, great magazines to you quarter after quarter, whether it's Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine, our brewing industry guide, or our video classes, also available to all access subscribers. Dave, if people want to learn more about Big Dogs, where can they find you out there on the internet? And then if they want to taste Big Dogs beer while they're here in Las Vegas, where should people come and find you?
Well, you got to come here to our brewery, 4543 North Rancho. We're in Las Vegas. We are on the northwest side of town, but, you know, from the Venetian, I guess where everyone's going to be at, it's about 20 minutes drive. Not too bad, but we're right off the freeway. So I highly suggest people coming out here. We're going to have a bunch of cool stuff going on, events through the week, live music, and a bunch of beer on tap. We're trying to push a lot of local Nevada beers, not just obviously our beer, but we're going to have the whole front area blocked off with about 50 beers, a good mix of Nevada, Las Vegas beers being poured out there along with ours.
Like an ongoing beer festival up here at Big
Dogs. So we have an event, I know, to add to our stress here, but we have an event. It's our Peace, Love, and Hoppiness. It's on 420. So if anyone is going to be here before you know, the official CBC sure. kickoff. We'll have an event here, a festival, and then it carries over. We'll leave all the infrastructure, all the 40 or 50 taps that we're going to have out there, everything. So, you know, come on by, you know, discounts for obviously CBC people. And yeah, you can try our beers here or anywhere up and down the strip, you know, really. But yeah, that's that.
Awesome. Well, Dave, good luck in this year's competition.
Oh, gosh.
We'll see what you come back with. Hopefully, I'm going to knock on wood and not jinx it for you.
Yeah.
Maybe I have. It's the worst thing to put these podcasts out right before that competition. You're like, damn it. Wow. Why did we even say that?
Yeah, can we edit this, please?
you know, I'm sure you're looking forward to welcoming brewers from all around the country into Las Vegas and sharing your approach to brewing. It's been great talking to you about it.
Yeah. Thank Cheers. You. Thank you for having us.
This podcast has been brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those who love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew.